Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, as one local city considers adding In God We Trust to the city council chambers, we look at the role religion plays in local politics. We'll also find out about some big changes that could be in store for Fresno City College as the campus prepares for a $250 million construction effort over the next decade. College President Carol Goldsmith will join us. We'll also learn more about a new series of public opinion surveys taking the temperatures of San Joaquin Valley residents on everything from healthcare to immigration. That and a new publishing imprint that focuses on fiction works from local authors. We'll hear about a new novel from Judge James Ardize. We begin, though, with an issue that is close to residents up and down the valley, having safe drinking water. In 2012, California made history when it became the first U.S. state to declare that clean drinking water is a human right. But 5 years later, nearly 300 communities still can't drink their water, according to new state data, many of which are in the San Joaquin Valley. Today, we debut a series about drinking water in which we explore where these communities are and why it's so difficult to get clean water. FM 89's Ezra David Romero and Carrie Klein start off in rural Fresno County, north of Lemoore.
Angel Hernandez moved to the 600-person community of Lanier in the late 80s. He soon realized something was wrong with the water.
When you would turn on your faucet, the water would come out in a yellow color and had it like a sulfur, and it'd make you cough.
Now he says the discoloration has gone away. But there's still a major problem.
You can see it's clear. You can't tell. The arsenic is in it that we can't see.
Arsenic is a chemical element that occurs naturally in the ground, and it can leach into the water supply. In high enough doses, it can lead to vomiting, diarrhea, and long-term health impacts like heart disease, neurological problems, and cancer.
Lanier has dealt with arsenic contamination for decades. After a persistent community outcry, they eventually got federal money for what they thought would be a solution. It sits right in the middle of town. Lanier resident Isabel Solorio points it out.
Here is the project when they made to water treatment plant.
They built an arsenic treatment plant. But here's the thing. For the past 10 years, it sat lifeless. The $1.3 million facility only ran for 6 months. It was too expensive to operate, and the town quickly racked up debt. Veronica Garibay is a co-director of the Fresno-based nonprofit Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability. She says the community still owes around $30,000.
They also now have to pay off a debt of an arsenic treatment plant that sits in their community and is a symbolic reminder of we could have had clean water, but we can't afford it.
Now Lanier's moved on to another solution. We'll have more on that later.
Lanier's not the only California community struggling for clean water. There are around 290 others dealing with problems like arsenic, nitrates, and uranium. Around 400,000 Californians are impacted. And more than half of those live here, in the San Joaquin Valley. In Kings County, for example, 40% of residents have unsafe drinking water. That's almost half its population.
These numbers come from a new website the State Water Board launched earlier this year. It's called the Human Right to Water Portal. There you can find data about every public water system in the state and all violations from the last 5 years. Wendy Kilu is an environmental scientist with the Water Board.
This portal was produced to provide another level of transparency when it comes to letting the public know what's in their drinking water.
The data doesn't include contaminants like 1,2,3-TCP, a carcinogen that's really common in drinking water. When the state begins regulating that chemical later this year, the number of impacted residents throughout California could skyrocket.
To get some context, we turn to the Community Water Center in Visalia, where just inside the front door, there's a table covered with water bottles of different colors.
So here we have a variety of tap waters from different communities in the Central Valley.
Susana DeAnda is the co-founder and co-director of the advocacy group, which works to help Californians gain access to safe and affordable drinking water. She says 400,000 people, that's too many.
That's a big number, and we're talking about people's lives and students and parents and families. It should be that all Californians can thrive and drink tap water without the fear of becoming sick.
She says the fact that so many Valley communities have dirty water follows an all too common trend.
There's plenty of studies that can show if you're low income and a person of color, as I am, you're going to have higher chances of having polluted water. That is not okay.
Jay Lund is the director of the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. He helps explain this trend.
Any place in the world, no matter how developed you are, it's usually the small systems that have the biggest problems. The economics means that they don't have much economies of scale, so that it's pretty expensive to do anything.
400,000 residents amounts to about 1% of the state. And Lund says that's just about what he'd expect. Any lower, and he'd be suspicious that water agencies weren't doing their jobs.
If compliance was 100% and there were no systems out of compliance, that would cause me to worry that people weren't actually looking at it.
Still, in places like Lanier that are in that 1%, the problem may seem insurmountable. It's taken nearly a decade to regain the momentum after their treatment plant failed. Isabel Solorio shows me two wells the state's begun digging.
This is a part of a new well. They need to finish the project.
They've just dug it right now.
Just dug it only.
They hope by digging wells in different places, they'll find water free of arsenic and that it'll be cheaper than getting the treatment plant running.
But after decades of disappointment, the community is skeptical the solution will work. Angel Hernandez says this new phase has already been going on for 2 years.
They tell us they're supposed to be starting in 2017. They're going to start doing one thing or another thing. So we're there now.
So why is it so hard to solve this problem?
And whose responsibility is it to provide clean water? We'll answer those questions and visit other communities in later stories.
With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. Religion and politics are once again mixing, this time at Fresno City Hall. One council member has put forward a plan to add the words "In God We Trust" to the council chamber wall. As Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports, the proposal highlights the connection between politics and the city's religious faithful.
The Wilson Theater in downtown Fresno comes alive on Sundays when it transforms into the Christian Cornerstone Church, the home of Pastor Jim Franklin. The theme of the sermon this weekend is organizing your life to put Jesus first. But there's a different person in the audience Franklin wants to share the stage with, who has a decidedly different, more political message. Councilmember Gary Bredefeld takes the stage to rally support for a resolution he's put before the city council, adding "In God We Trust" to the council chamber wall. Speaking in his office at City Hall, Bredefeld says adding the inscription, which is the official motto of the United States, would remind council members they are there to work for the benefit of the citizens.
This is not about selecting one religion over another. That's something I would never support. This is about adopting our national motto, which simply says that "In God We Trust," which is, for me, about faith, values, and patriotism.
To rally support, Bredefeld is taking his message right to the religious community. The Cornerstone Church handed out small flyers with every council member's office number, and the pastor urged his parishioners to call City Hall and press for a vote. The proposal is sure to draw some opposition, but if it's approved, could be a sign that Fresno's churches hold significant political sway. The initiative excites Cornerstone Church member Ashley Jackson.
Absolutely, just because that's how the state believes, is "In God We Trust." Goes back to our founding fathers, so absolutely.
And there are thousands of Fresnans just like her who can flex the accumulated muscle of the religious community. Religion is one of those issues that in many ways can cut across party lines. Black churches in Southwest Fresno who generally back Democrats are just as much a driving force as Republican powerhouse megachurches in Bredefeld's Northeast Fresno district. Pastor Jim Franklin says if a politician wants to get elected in Fresno, it makes sense to reach out to the churches to look for political support and not be shy about it.
I think this is a town that has Judeo-Christian values as a whole. I think we've seen that historically. So if I were running for office, then of course I would want to align myself with those values so that I could represent them.
Looking back at the last few mayors, Franklin might have a point. Jim Patterson still owns a radio station and is active in Christian broadcasting. Alan Autry has made and continues to produce Christian-themed movies. He has one out this year. Ashley Swearingen was seen as less outwardly religious, but her husband is a pastor, and she was often spotted at religious events. And current mayor Lee Brand, whose public image is more wonk and bee counter than proselytizer, got a big boost during the race in the summer when H. Spees, who is deeply involved in the religious community, endorsed him over Henry Perea. Fresno State history professor Dan Cady says the influence of the churches is a signal that Fresno still considers itself a small town. To that end, even if one isn't particularly religious, they have to at least reach out to the church community if they want to have any shot of winning election and being effective, because churches might not be where deals get done, but it's often where they start.
Fresno politicians seem to treat the church in the same way that corporate interests treat golf courses, that they all end up at the same place and they have these informal meetings that solidify the different relationships in politics.
But that does make things complicated in a city with a very diverse religious community, including Muslims, Jews, Sikhs, and Hmong animist, in addition to Protestant and Catholic Christians. Cady says you might not have to wrap yourself in the scripture, but your political future benefits greatly by being involved with the church.
And there's no greater charge, appears in Fresno politics, greater than atheists.
There will be some pushback against the move. The Interfaith Alliance of Central California is against it, saying in a written statement it's exclusionary and that "In God We Trust" is clearly a reference to a Christian God. Quote, "One look at the list of Christian voices in support of this proposal offers a tell as to the assumed nature and character of God as would be portrayed by the signage. They suggest posting Justice for All instead." There's also a potential that the move could draw a lawsuit because some claim the motto violates the First Amendment. However, those cases have repeatedly lost in court. More than 100 California cities display the motto "In God We Trust," including 15 in Fresno County alone, according to Bakersfield-based In God We Trust America, Incorporated. And if Fresno is the newest and largest city in the Central Valley to join that list, it will be another sign that religion still plays a foundational role in city politics. The vote is on May 11th. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. There's a new set of public opinion polls about what San Joaquin Valley residents think about a variety of issues, from the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act to water and immigration. They're the work of the Institute for Leadership and Public Policy, a new project out at Fresno State. Joining us now, we have Annabel Espana and Jeffrey Cummins, both faculty members at Fresno State and co-directors of the Institute. Welcome to both of you. Jeffrey, I want to start with you. How exactly did this project come about? As you've got the political science department, Chicano and Latino studies coming together and doing these opinion polls.
Well, the College of Social Sciences got a donation from Chevron and PG&E, and our dean, Michelle Dembesti, was looking to do some projects with the money, and one theme of it was supposed to be leadership. So one aspect of the Institute is training students to become public service leaders in the Valley. So we have an internship program and a fellowship program where students work with faculty members on research projects. Interns work in local public service agencies. And then another big component of it is these surveys. So we came up with the idea that we wanted to do some public opinion surveys of the San Joaquin Valley. To my knowledge, there's nothing like this has ever been done. We have several organizations that conduct statewide surveys, the famous field poll, which actually just closed down and moved over to UC Berkeley. We have the Public Policy Institute of California. They do statewide surveys, but none of them do it of our region. And we thought it was really important to start getting a sense of public sentiment for this region. There's a lot of important state and national issues that impact this region, such as the Affordable Care Act, which has been in the news quite a bit lately, and immigration. And so we wanted to get a sense for where people in the Valley stood on these issues.
So let's go ahead and dig into some of these and start with water. Annabelle, let's go with you on this one. One in five adults say in the Valley say access to clean drinking water is a problem. Give us some more insights into that.
Well, I think what we're seeing there is a little bit, it's true that although we've gotten a lot more water this winter, which is great news, and we're having to deal with different kinds of issues in water management, I think one of the things we're seeing in the Valley is that access to clean water is still a real concern for a lot of people. And that has to do maybe with contamination, as you guys have been talking about, but also in terms of the well access. So I think what we see in that number is both things kind of come together.
Was there anything specific in the breakdown of who reported that this is a concern of theirs?
Well, I think in terms of race, at least, and ethnicity, we've sort of seen that overall that there is a bit of a breakdown there, with most people sort of having not being too concerned with it. But I think where we see maybe a little bit more interesting breakdown is in terms of the party ID. So Democrats and independents are more likely than Republicans, for instance, to be concerned about access to drinking water. So I think that kind of speaks a little bit about maybe where those groups are living, perhaps.
And then, Jeff, also 75% of respondents said they were very concerned or somewhat concerned about the future of the water supply. This goes, I take it, beyond just drinking water?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, we didn't specify here in the actual question to respondents, but I think certainly given the 5-year drought, you have these wells that are running dry in outlying communities, you have, you know, ongoing problems with clean water and contamination, you have problems with the agricultural industry getting enough water to water crops and so on. And I think just the ongoing attention to this issue is certainly causing a lot of concern among the population. And I think, you know, when you're seeing over 70% of adults in this case identified it as a problem, I think there's some very serious concerns there, and rightly so.
Tell me a little more about the methodology behind not only this particular question, but the other ones which we're about to talk about.
Yeah, in terms of what we did is we decided to do the entire San Joaquin Valley, which is 8 counties, all the way up to San Joaquin County, down to Kern County. So it's a population of about 4 million people. And so we needed to get a sample size that was big enough to represent that. Actually, when you boil it down to adults, it's closer to about 3 million. When you take out the children. So we needed to get a sample size that was going to be representative of that population. We chose to, and there's, you know, different ways of doing this methodology, especially today. A lot of polling is moving online. In this particular case, we did actual live calling. We called landlines and we called cell phones. We conducted it in Spanish and English, given our heavy Spanish-speaking population in the San Joaquin Valley. And we ended up for this sample with about 540 respondents. And in particular, you want to get that sample size up to reduce the margin of error. So we had a margin of error of about 4.2%, which is pretty good in a survey of this size. So,
again, we're talking about a series of new public opinion polls released by the Institute for Leadership and Public Policy at Fresno State. That voice you hear is Jeffrey Cummins, political science professor at Fresno State. We also have with us Annabelle España, professor in Chicano and Latino Studies at Fresno State. One of the other surveys that came out last week, data out on the views of San Joaquin Valley residents on immigration and deportation. Specifically, nearly half of San Joaquin Valley adults in this survey are worried about deportations, either themselves or a family member. Tell me more about the findings here, Annabelle.
Yeah, I think this was particularly disturbing because definitely the numbers we're seeing out of the Valley are much higher than the national average, and also higher than what we see out of the coast, out of LA, where there is a larger undocumented population as well. And so I think what we see is that there is, you know, not surprisingly, in the agricultural field, there's a lot of undocumented workers, mostly Latinos, although not only Latinos. And so there's a definite concern that they or someone they know, so a close someone close to the family will or might be deported, sort of with a lot of the new rhetoric that we see coming out of the Trump administration and the new kind of more lenient mandate seems to be out of ICE.
Now, Jeff, I look at this data that you present here, and you break this one down not only by ethnicity and party registration, but also by whether people voted in the presidential election and also whether they were a Trump supporter or not, or at least identify as a Trump supporter. Does that mean necessarily that they voted for Trump? Or tell me a little more about the breakdown there and what we find on this question in regards to how it relates to the election.
Yeah, what we did on the Trump supporter question is that we had a question that asked people how they voted in the presidential election for Trump or Clinton. And then for those, because we sampled adults, a lot of polls do registered voters or likely voters. We chose to do adults because there's a pretty good portion of our population here in the San Joaquin Valley that is not a registered voter. And so for this particular survey, we wanted to capture all adults. So we asked them, if you had voted, who would you have voted for? So that Trump supporter is a respondent who indicated that they actually voted for Trump or they would have voted for Trump. And we wanted to capture, what that sentiment is like here in the Valley in terms of what impact the Trump policies are having on people in the Valley and whether or not they're supporting these initiatives of the Trump administration. And so in this particular case, the non-Trump supporters, if we can call them that, there was a very high percentage. 63% of them indicated that they feared that they or someone they knew was going to be deported, which is, what we would expect given a lot of the rhetoric during the Trump campaign and then certainly a lot of the news stories that are coming out in the crackdown on undocumented immigrants here in the Valley.
And among Trump supporters, any signs of a change of thought on that, or are they firmly behind the president's positions moving forward on immigration?
No, I don't think we see any shift in this at all. You have it's close to 90% of people that are Trump supporters that don't fear deportations, and we've seen, and not particularly in this poll, but in other polls, where Trump supporters have been asked about their satisfaction with the Trump administration policies so far, and they're very satisfied. Over 90% of Trump supporters in some of these other polls are satisfied with what the administration is doing.
Annabelle, what do we see there?
I think also in that set of questions that we added about deportations, we see that about 38% of Trump supporters think that deportation is going to be positive for the Valley. And so I think that is also a significant number you see that continuation of support for that kind of policy.
Yeah, and continuing on with that thought, again, a majority in the San Joaquin Valley think that more deportations will have a negative impact on the region's economy. Does that speak to a demographic issue, or does it also speak to the region's agricultural economy and concerns that deportations might reduce the available labor pool for Valley farmers?
I think that there's definitely something here about agriculture and the importance of the undocumented workforce for that sector. I think it also probably has something to do with the fact that, as we saw in the previous question, that a lot of people know someone who may be undocumented too. And so there seems to be concern about that population and then this idea that they're, removing them from the Valley would have sort of negative repercussions.
Was there anything surprising on this, Jeff, or anything you didn't expect to find? I see that Republicans are divided on this issue of whether there will be a negative impact here. Did that maybe jump out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a good one to highlight. You don't see a clear majority of respondents who identified themselves as Republican as saying that it's had a positive or negative impact. And I think that kind of goes to maybe the conflict that Republicans, particularly here in the Valley, and we've seen this in some of the news reports that are saying where we have this agricultural industry and there seemed to be pretty strong support for the Trump administration, but at the same time, some of their policies that Trump supports cut across against what cut across the interests of the agricultural industry here in the Valley.
sort of the David Valadao effect, I guess you could say, backing a lot of policies of the Trump administration, but maybe some questions on the effect of one of those policies.
Yeah, certainly.
Moving on, also, in fact, the first of these surveys that you released 2 weeks ago involves a Valley residents' opinion of the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Nearly half of respondents oppose the repeal of Obamacare. Again, Annabelle, what do you see in this question specifically to the response to voters and people who are this residents here in the Valley?
Well, I think that there is sort of the sense that the repeal of Obamacare will not necessarily be good for a large sector of the Valley. And that probably has to do with the fact that a lot of people, all residents in the Valley, have benefited from those new policies. There seems to be not, you know, they would rather keep or at least sections of Obamacare, of the Health Care Act.
But, Jeff, even of Trump supporters, even of registered Republicans, you do not have a clear majority in favor of repealing all provisions of the act. And tell me a little more about what we see there.
Well, I think it's interesting that, you know, as we came to this this vote, and I'm talking about the first vote in Congress, which eventually Speaker Paul Ryan pulled off the floor because there wasn't enough support to oppose repeal. But we saw as it came to a head in Congress, we started to see, and just not particularly this public opinion poll, but in others, that there was this rising support for Obamacare. And I think that is certainly reflected here. You know, if you just look at those who think that at least some part of Obamacare should be repealed and those that appeal, it's about 70% of people. So you have a very small percentage of the population who actually wants to repeal all provisions. And so I think you kind of see that those reservations that Republican members of Congress had, that Trump certainly had as well, in carrying through with the repeal of Obamacare, that this would certainly impact a lot of people who are becoming educated about the benefits of Obamacare.
One other thing, looking at these numbers here, Jeff and Annabelle, only 62% of Democrats surveyed in this poll say that they oppose repeal. Now, again, you break it down by repeal all, repeal some, or oppose repeal and then don't know. I would have thought that number might have been higher, considering the party's overall stance on that issue. What do you read into that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a recognition, and everybody recognizes this, including former President Obama recognized this, that it was a flawed act, and there needed to be some fixes to it. So I think that's certainly being recognized here, that there are some provisions that need to be tinkered with so that it has a more positive impact on health insurance coverage and helps to reduce the cost of health insurance.
And was this survey conducted before the bill died or after the bill died, the initial bill that was out there that Speaker Ryan pulled back in March?
It was done before. Yeah, before.
Okay, and Annabelle, this before we go, our last survey question here. Over 40% of residents in the Valley believe someone in their household will lose health insurance under the repeal of Obamacare. Tell us a little more about the data there.
Yeah, I think that shows a little bit how important this healthcare reform has been for the Valley. And it also shows, of course, the potential negatives of having that reappealed or taken away from people. And so there is a high percentage of people in the Valley who have benefited from the expansion of healthcare in California. And I think it shows, you know, it explains to a great extent why so many people are kind of don't want to see the whole thing reappealed, right? Because it's going to have a personal effect on someone that they know. So I think that what we see is, you know, in the Valley, it's pretty much what we're seeing at the national level, that there, you know, a lot of people have benefited from the reform. Not everybody's very happy with the reform or sections of, and this lack of agreement of exactly how to move forward now, right? What do we reappeal? What do we not? What do we change? What do we keep? I think that's going to be the challenge for policymakers.
Fresno State Professors Annabelle Espana and Jeffrey Cummins, both faculty members and co-directors of the Institute for Leadership and Public Policy at Fresno State. You can find these public opinion polls and more on the FresnoStateNews.com website. Also, do you have your own site for this, Jeff?
Yeah. access it through the College of Social Sciences, and the Institute has its own website as well.
All right. We'll look that up, and I know there's more of these to come. We look forward to them. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and find out about some big changes on the way for Fresno City College construction. Around $250 million of improvements over the next decade. They're trying to figure out how to spend that money. That's coming up next, plus a new imprint for local novelists. We'll hear from Judge James Ardize and the people behind this new publication venture. That's coming up on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. It's been a little less than a year since Carol Goldsmith became the new president of Fresno City College. A lot has happened since then. The campus is moving ahead with building plans made possible thanks to Measure C, a $485 million bond measure approved by voters last year for the State Center Community College District. A good portion of that money is being set aside for FCC, and the campus is currently reaching out to the community as part of that effort. Carol Goldsmith joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Carol, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciate the time.
Before we talk about the building projects that are going on, when you took this position a little less than a year ago, you said you would go about listening to the campus.
Yes, I have.
What have you heard?
Well, one thing I've heard, not only on the campus, but in our community at whole, so many people's careers started at Fresno City College. I'm amazed every day how many notable alumni are in leadership positions and throughout Fresno and actually throughout the Valley. We're the number one trainer in our first responders. You know, our nursing program is the largest in the state of California. We have a fire and police academy that trains the bulk of our police and fire throughout the city. In fact, our fire captain here at Fresno is an alumni. Margaret Mims is an alumni. I've been amazed at how many people, not only in the healthcare profession, but just average people have started their career at Fresno State, started their career at Fresno City College and then transferred to Fresno State.
And you yourself, a Fresno State alum.
I am and a proud alum.
Back in Fresno now, you had served as president of West Hills College in Coalinga.
Yes, I am.
And now here, was that a difficult decision to leave West Hills and come here?
You know, it was and it wasn't. I love West Hills. I was there for a number of years, but my home is Fresno, and I never got rid of my home where I raised my children. So for me, it was really about coming home. It was perfect timing. My son was coming home from the Army, and I have a grandson, so it was all about coming home and serving my hometown.
So let's move on to the items at hand with
sure.
This big spending, big building project that is spending a lot of money to improve the campus. What is in store for Fresno City College as far as change and new construction?
Sure. Well, I think it's important, to thank all the voters because, $500 million will be spent throughout the Valley, both at Reedley College, Clovis, Madera Center, Oakhurst, and, of course, at California's first community college, which is Fresno City College. About $225 million of it will be going to Fresno City College. We'll be doing a number of building projects. One is that we're going to be looking at our police and fire academies, making sure they have a brand new home that really is high tech and really suits their needs. They're training the Valley majority of first responders in old facilities. So we want to bring those facilities up to date. Also, we'll be focusing on our Career Technical Center, which is out on Jensen and Annandale. We do automotive training out there, manufacturing, a whole host of industrial type careers. We'll be revamping that and looking at possibly new facilities for that whole so important career technical education, making sure people have the right education to get the jobs. And then, of course, looking at math and science right now, we know that the bulk of new careers are focusing in that whole math, science, and engineering. It's our largest division, so we'll be having a brand new home for math, science, and engineering. And, of course, if you've ever been at Fresno City College, we have a bit of a parking issue. So we are looking at parking expansion and addressing some of the challenges there and coming up with new and creative solutions to our parking concerns.
So one unique thing about your college is it's a historic site.
Yes.
You have the old administration building. You're in a historic part of town.
Yes.
Surrounded by neighborhoods.
Yes.
So there's not really a place to grow out so much.
It, that presents an interesting challenge for us. So we're working very closely with our community partners and our neighbors, as well as our architects. That's why the event on May 22nd is so important. We want to make sure that we honor the historical preservation of that entire area. And we also understand that we're an urban college. In fact, we're the fifth largest city in the state. Fresno City College is the first community college in California, and we want to honor that historic legacy. So our solution has to reflect our urban nature.
So how do you go about being a good neighbor with trying to grow and sure. offer more services sure. as the enrollment has grown?
Right.
Sometimes you hear from neighbors in the area, well, people are parking on my street, or there's impacts to the community. How do you try to balance those things?
Certainly. One thing, we're working very closely with our neighbors. In fact, this was be the second event that we had. The first event was last week. ASG, our student leaders, along with myself and some faculty, we walked the neighborhood, personally inviting our neighbors. We walked about a mile radius around the campus, inviting people, wanting them to be part of the conversation. We're working very closely with our council members at City Hall, as well as the mayor's office. Both Mayor Brand and Councilwoman Soria were at the event. I suspect they'll be at subsequent conversations. It's important for us to be able to hear our neighbors in our community. And, you know, I tell you, I was impressed by the number of solutions that our neighbors gave us. And I think Councilwoman Soria had some information that she may take back and do a little homework on as well. So we'll continue to work very closely with the city and our community.
How much of the spending for the new construction is set in stone at this point? Now, when voters approved this, there was talk, you know, the Mass Science Building is part of this. But how much is still to be determined versus how much is we already know that we're going to do A, B, and C?
Sure. Well, the A, B, and C is pretty much already laid out in terms of the projects itself. Again, it's police and fire academies. It's the new career technical center. It'll be Mass Science and Engineering parking expansion. Then also there'll be a new West Fresno campus, and that endeavor is also on a parallel track, working with the community in West Fresno and really making sure we listen to those voices. There's been a lot of work done with the new Southwest Fresno plan that was presented recently to the Fresno Chamber of Commerce, as well as the City Council. So we take a look at that, and that will help inform our decisions. We're right now creating stakeholder groups for that particular area, making sure we hear all the voices and work closely with them. And Oliver Baines, because that is the councilman who represents that area.
What sort of programs do you see offering or being offered in that campus?
Sure. Well, one of the things we do know now is that we want to ask the residents and the students who are from West Fresno now, and looking at their majors, it's a whole host of majors. Many of them, students, like all students, want to transfer to the four-year. So I suspect we'll see some very high academic programs, as well as probably some career technical programs as well. Those are the conversations that we need to have with the residents and the employers to find out what's really needed. And we want to make sure whatever we have, it'll be transferable to the university level as well.
Going back to the construction, you
sure.
mentioned parking and looking for creative solutions. Is that as simple as building a parking garage, or is it something else that you're looking at?
Well, you know, we're looking at a lot of things. Right now, we're in discussions with Fresno State about writing a grant for how do we use technology to do better ride sharing to reduce the number of cars that students take. I think our student population now are very concerned about the environment, so not everybody drives a car. Many people are into ride sharing. We want to be able to see if we can create a platform that would allow for people to take a better use of ride sharing. So we'll be continuing to work with our partners, both at the Air District Board, Fresno State, and working with the folks at Better Blackstone, a whole organization focusing on how do we reduce our carbon emissions and make better use of our space. So yes, we need parking space, but I also think we need to change some of the behaviors of how we transport one another.
As part of this plan, do you see efforts from the campus to try to integrate with what the city is doing on Blackstone and the Bus Rapid Transit line that'll begin operating within the next year?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, what we're looking at is we've been in conversation with the city looking at those bus routes, but what we want to do is try to kind of align our start times so they'll also be in sync with classes starting on time. The fact that rapid transit is going to be coming right down in front of our campus really may change the front door of Fresno City College, and we're pretty excited by it.
Are there any plans to do that, to extend more towards Blackstone? You have obviously Ratcliffe and some administrative support functions that go up to Blackstone, but the heart of the campus is more towards the neighborhood there.
Sure. Well, you know, Fresno City College, when it was first built many, over 100 years ago, it was really on the outskirts of town. And now the town has really grown up around Fresno City. And as you pointed out, we have Ratcliffe Stadium across the street where, you know, it was the place where dreams were broken. We want to continue to have that facility be restored to its heyday. While it's not part of the bond project, we are very aware of the needs that we need to be able to improve Ratcliffe Stadium, to restore it to its grandeur. And we also have a number of programs that are across the street. So we'll be working and trying to look at what does our footprint look like. Right now, all of the possibilities are on the table. You know, one thing about being a city college is that while our footprint is currently in one location, we do have the ability to look at multiple locations. So we're going to be trying to figure out what's best for our students, what's best for our community.
I want to go back to something you mentioned about career technical education. There's so much talk about that right now from State Center, your campus as part of that. Fresno Unified is talking about that on the statewide and even the national level. That's one of the buzzwords out there right now. With all those things going on, how do you make sure that you're not being duplicative of other services and trying to make all these things work together and fit the needs of where the jobs actually are?
Right.
Because we've heard about that disconnect for a long time. I'm not sure how much that still exists, but how do you see the activities that you plan on taking as part of this project fitting in with everything else?
Sure. Well, one thing about the California Community College systems, a few years ago, I had the distinct pleasure and honor of serving on a statewide task force focusing on workforce development and the new careers that California is looking for and making sure we have the proper training that really creates these guided pathways from K-12 to the university to employment. So the work that Fresno City College has done has really been in tandem working with Jim Yovino at the Fresno County Office of Education, working with all the good folks at Fresno Unified and how we can marry our programs together. In fact, currently, we have a number of our college programs that students can take at the local high school and start their college career early in their high school years. So we're working very closely with Fresno Unified and Central Unified, as well as our employers. So that disconnect, I think, is narrowing, and we're seeing more alignment both from the K-12, the community college, and the CSU. I'm really proud of the work that we're going to be doing, especially as it relates to career technical education and looking at how we do our new facilities out at Annandale and Jensen.
What's the timeline for construction? Is this on the near horizon, or is this something that we're going to see in the next decade?
You know what? I think it's probably more of a five to 10 year outlook right now. Right now, we are in the discovery phase. We're looking at gathering information both from the campus. We've had a host of planning sessions with faculty and staff. We had the community event. We'll have another community event. So April, May, June, we're in discovery. And then we're working with our architectural planners and other folks in the city to make sure we compile and review this data and really try to come up with a plan. Our goal is to be able to work over the summer. And then when our faculty come back in August and September, we'll review the plans that we have for possible site locations for various places and have more campus dialogue and then take something to the board for their approval in October, November. So that'll be the planning process. And as you can well imagine, working with California Department DSA and our architectural approval process, that takes some time. So I suspect over the next 5 years, you're going to see a lot of growth going on at Fresno City College.
You have this event coming up. Tell us about it.
So yeah, it's May 22nd. It's the second part of a conversation that we started. And in fact, in many aspects, I think this meeting is even more important than our first conversation. The first conversation was about reminding people about Measure C, what we are going to be doing. This is going to be more of an action-oriented whiteboarding session with our architectural planners. That's why it's so important that we get our community members out out. We want to hear from the community. We're following up with everyone who attended that first meeting. They'll be personally invited to come back, coming on to your show, letting other people know. Even if you didn't go to the first meeting, we want to have you there. We want to hear from you. May 22nd, 5:30 to 7:30 in the old administration building.
Lots of big things on the drawing boards for the oldest community college in California, Fresno City College, getting about half of the proceeds from Measure C, that $485 million bond measure, new construction, including parking and new facilities for important programs there and other sites throughout the community.
One more thing for your listeners. You know, Fresno City College, besides being the first, currently, we're serving about 34,000 students. So I thank you, everybody at Fresno City College. Thanks, the voters. All of our students, thank you. And thank you for having me on the show.
Carol Goldsmith, president of Fresno City College, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is Valley Edition. Pace Press is a new publishing imprint that is bringing readers worldwide fiction works by writers from the Valley and beyond. Joining us now in our studio to talk about two new books that are out, or actually one book that's out and one book that's almost out, we have from Pace Press, Jaguar Bennett and Heather Parrish. Welcome to you both. Jaguar, this is a project that's been in the works for the last year or so, and it's a sub-imprint of a publishing firm who's locally based and has been working on a number of local books, but this one focuses on fiction. Tell us about how Pace Press came about.
Well, we've published nonfiction for decades now. The company's started in about 1979, and we publish woodworking books, history books, general nonfiction. And Pace Press came about because we found that so many of our nonfiction authors have fiction projects in the works. The two books that are currently on the Pace Press lineup, one is Memortality by Stephen H. Provo, who wrote an excellent book of Fresno history called Fresno Growing Up. He's got another history book in the works that's coming out soon called Highway 99. And our upcoming legal thriller, Fractured Justice, by James Ardaes. Ardaes also wrote a nonfiction true crime book a few years ago called Hands Through Stone, which was about Ardaes' involvement in the investigation and prosecution of Clarence Ray Allen. So these are two excellent writers. They had a proven track record with their nonfiction. And when they were interested in doing fiction, we decided this is something we should jump on.
Heather, you're involved in this project and reading a lot of these works. Are you focusing just on Valley writers, or how do you define what Pace Press is all about?
Well, we're open to writers from anywhere. We do distribute worldwide, and we are a traditional publishing company in that we offer royalties. So it's all very by the book. But we are Fresno-based. We do have a heart for Fresno. We're very involved in the community. And we'd like to look at Valley writers and what they're willing to put out there right now.
So we had Stephen Provo on our program back when Fresno Growing Up came out, and a great book. He has been a journalist and has been writing these nonfiction works. Tell us about what he's doing with this fiction work.
Well, Memortality is a contemporary fantasy. It's set in a realistic world, but it involves certain magical abilities. It's about a young woman who has a photographic memory, which gives her this power of bringing people back to life. And it's a kind of eerie book. It has elements of horror and suspense, as well as fantasy. The question is, if you could bring people back to life, would you? Is it desirable? Some people are good, some people are not.
Interesting. We'll have to look that out. Now, that one is already out in stores and online. The other one that you have, Fractured Justice, from Justice James Ardaes, who joins us on the phone now. I want to welcome Judge Ardaes to our program. Judge Ardaes, how did you go about transitioning to dabbling in the area of creative fiction?
Well, it was a fairly easy transition for me. I think Hands Through Stone was written as narrative nonfiction. And so really, with my background in the judiciary, as well as formerly the chief of homicide, I was able to move into this area. And I thought about write what you know. So this is an area that I know.
So tell us a little more about what Fractured Justice is all about.
Fractured Justice is part of a series of books. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was the evolution of attorneys, particularly a prosecutor in this case, as they confront the realities of the law. Young person tending to look at things in very black and white terms, and then finally realizing that the situations that you're confronted with are not that clear cut. The choices that you make are not that clear cut. It's an evolution of a young man and his participation in the justice system. And that's the approach that I've taken.
Is writing fiction in some ways more liberating or more freeing for an author who has previously done narrative nonfiction? Did you find a different experience approaching this work in that genre?
It is a very different experience. First of all, in terms of nonfiction, you're pretty much sticking to the facts. You are sticking to the facts, and you don't move away from that much, and you don't have any flexibility, really. But with respect to fiction writing, you do have more flexibility. It's a different kind of writing, so there's suspense involved. And I wrote the kind of book that I would like to read, as opposed to a lot of what I see written, which I think is not very realistic. So I think this is definitely realistic, and I think it takes the reader along with the protagonist and as the story evolves, so they have an opportunity to see it not just from his perspective, but also from a detached perspective, and go through to the end and kind of make their own judgments.
I see the sample cover of the book here says this is the first in a new legal thriller series. Are there more to come from your pen?
There are more to come. I'm almost finished with the second in the series, and I expect that hopefully, if it's well received, that that people will want to find out more about what happens to this young man as well as the justice system.
I want to turn back to Jaguar Bennett now from Pace Press. Jaguar, the publishing industry, the media industry is in such a state of change right now. Some people might say, why start a new publishing imprint now? What about the challenge of doing that in this new climate that we have? E-books are the big thing, and all the business models seem to be changing.
Well, I'll tell you one of the secrets of the publishing industry, which is that actually this is a golden age for literature. More people are reading books now than ever before. Now, ebooks are a very important factor. All of our titles are also available in ebook formats. But actually, ebooks, they've kind of leveled off. They have, they're very strong. They're very important. People enjoy ebooks. People also enjoy print books as well. And we find that they're selling in equal measures. One of the interesting things of the history of media is that no new medium has ever totally replaced another one, which is why we're on the radio right now.
Exactly. We like to believe in that theory, definitely, here in public radio. As far as the plans moving forward, Heather, you're reading submissions right now. Jaguar, I imagine that the business plan here involves growth. How do you see this moving forward? Are you accepting new submissions right now? I guess I'll let you start with that, and then you follow up, because we're just about out of time.
Yes, we are accepting new submissions, and we're hoping to put out about 6 books a year. And so that's on track for next year. It takes about a year for a submission to get to print. So please send us any submissions you have, and you can find us online and get the submission info there.
And Jaguar, where can people get the books?
The books are available on Amazon, on barnesandnoble.com. They're also available at your local Barnes & Noble store and at other bookstores.
All right. Well, we'll look for them again. Fractured Justice comes out when?
in October.
October from Justice James Ardize, who joins us on the program today, and also the book Memorality. This is by Stephen Provost. It's also out right now on Pace Press. Thank you all for joining us. Great time, and wish you the best of luck. That's all for our program today on Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to remind you, you can let us know what you think by sending us an email, talk@kvpr.org, and sending us a tweet @KVPR and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.